Okay, a good point came up, and yesterday, Brother Dale asked me a question here that I think is a good question, and I had it in my mind, but I should have explained a little more thoroughly. In Isaiah 14:29, when we talked about the fiery flying serpent, you know, the root of the serpent is a cockatrice. Out of the root shall come a cockatrice, and the cockatrice fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent, as representative of Christ. What I mean by that is this. The fruit is a fiery flying serpent, would really be typical of the judgment. And not so much as Christ, because the point here is this. Would that make the serpent a type of Christ? If that is so, does that not violate proper hermeneutics in that using something evil as a type of good? Well, what it's representing really is the judgment. It's like Christ, it's like the serpent, the bronze serpent on the cross, or lifted up by Moses. You really wouldn't say that was a type of Christ. It does refer to Christ, but it's really representing the judgment on our sin. See, it's a serpent that's up there. It's a judgment on our sin. And so the fiery and flying serpent is really, I suppose, more fairly, I should say, it's representative of the judgment that comes through Christ. Now, that's in the one view. The other view would be, of course, referring to the Assyrian... Well, actually, the fiery flying serpent would be referring to the Antichrist now at the end of time. But it would be referring to Assyria, and then the end time Assyria, which would be... which would be through the Antichrist. You recall that the devil is typified by a lion. But so is Christ. Christ is typified by a lion. And there's something evil being used to represent something positive. The way it's used, though, is it's representing him as to his judgment again on the earth. As to his judgment. His nature is not like a lion, although he is the lion of the tribe of Judah. There clearly declares it. And the scripture does say, be wise as a serpent, doesn't it? So in a certain realm, you could be said to be likened unto a snake. Because you're wise like a snake, you're subtle, and so forth. And it would be referring to your wisdom, your stealth, your craftiness. And so you obviously have to take this in the, you know, in the sense in which it's meant. You wouldn't take the devil and say the devil represents Christ. You know, and of course that's taken to the furthest extreme, and the devil isn't even used to represent anybody. He is who he is. But as far as an image, it's interesting that the goat is sometimes used to represent the sinners that are lost. It's also used to represent Christ in the Old Testament, in the sacrifices, the goat. And the goat is and is black. Its hair is black. It's the opposite of the sheep, that's white. And in the final judgment, the sheep will go to the right hand, the goats will go to the left. Depart from me. It says that clearly. And yet it's used to typify Christ. It was clean. You could eat the goat. But you see how it's used to represent Christ. It's used as the one that takes on our sin, as the scapegoat, the one that takes on the judgment for us. And so you see, it's the way in which you view it, the angle in which you view it, that makes the largest distinction. Okay, back in chapter 15. But I'm glad you asked the question, because I wished I would have gone into that a little bit more thoroughly, actually, when we went through it. Isaiah chapter 15. We're talking about the destruction of Moab. And Moab's getting it. Verse 8. For the cry has gone round about the borders of Moab, the howling thereof unto Eglaim, and the howling thereof unto Beer Elam. Now, the borders of Moab. Eglaim is the very southwesternmost corner, and Beer Elam is the very northeastmost corner. And those two corners are the corners that stretch the furthest length of the land. In other words, that's the longest line that you could draw in the land mass of Moab. So it's saying from one border to the other, howling. Eglaim, the southwesternmost corner, and Beer Elam is the northeasternmost corner. Verse 9. For the waters of Dimon shall be full of blood, for I will bring more upon Dimon, lions upon him that escapes of Moab, and upon the remnant of the land. Dimon is the main city on the main river, Arnon. And it's saying that even though it's a large river, still the thing has become full of blood. And in another sense, the very light source of the nation is turned to blood. In other words, destruction. Destruction. And God also promises to bring lions upon them. God often used lions as a judgment. In Leviticus 26, 22, one of the judgments upon his people who will not keep his law is he will bring up wild beasts upon them. That's Leviticus 26, 22. And we also see the lion mentioned in Jeremiah 15, verse 3, and it was used at the time of Jeremiah. When they were not walking with God, lions were killing more of the people. Isn't that something? Others say that the lion here is figuratively representative of Judah, because Judah is mentioned as a lion in Genesis 49:9. Judah is mentioned as a lion. That's, I suppose, a possibility. Others say the lion here represents Babylon, because Babylon was figured as a lion. That was their main emblem, a lion. But I think that the basic meaning does refer to literal lions that were literally tearing the people and destroying them. Recognize now, these people are running for their lives. They're running out into the woods, and all of a sudden night falls. Guess who's awake at night prowling around? And so night falls, and they're in trouble. And they find there that the judgment of God follows them, and lions are killing the people. And once a lion starts killing people, oftentimes it will not eat them. It gets the taste of the sweet blood of the human, and pretty soon all it wants to do is just kill. And they have found that often in different parts of Africa and whatnot, India, that if a lion or a tiger tastes human blood, it doesn't want to eat anything else. And it'll oftentimes just to kill, not necessarily even to eat. And it just kind of gets, it can get into them, as it were. I don't know, maybe the demon is getting into them, a murderous demon or something. All right, but once they've got something like that, they have to usually go for them quick, because it won't stop now. Just, it'll lie wait. All right, chapter 16. Besides that, people are awful easy to put under, you know. That gazelle, he can run really fast. The humans, they're kind of sluggish and slow and, you know, easy prey when they don't have guns and so forth. All right. Continuing on, the same judgment of Moab, chapter 16 and verse 1. Send ye the lamb to the ruler of the land, from Selah to the wilderness, unto the mount of the daughter of Zion. What is it saying is this. Isaiah is prophesying to Moab. And he's showing, calling to them to acknowledge the Lord and to submit to the Lord. Now, Moab had previously been under submission. They had been defeated under David and had been under submission, but they had rebelled. In 2 Kings chapter 3, verses 4 and 5, we see that they had been brought under submission, but now they had rebelled. And God is saying, send the lamb. In other words, acknowledge Yahweh, sacrifice unto him, and do it all the way from Selah to the wilderness. Selah is now called Petra. And it was it's a very well-known city in the southernmost part of Moab, in the rocks. You say, well, wasn't Selah part of Edom? And it was during different parts of history, but at this time, evidently, it was under Moab dominion. Or some feel that even if it wasn't under Moab dominion, it was the place where many Moabites found refuge. They ran into the city and found safety there because it was a heavily fortified city because of where it was located in the valley there with the heavy rock cliffs around it. And essentially, therefore, what he is saying is that if you will submit and pay tribute to Judah, you will find release. Their only hope is submission. You know, when the devil's beating on you and judgment of God is on your life, the only hope you've got is submission. That's the only hope you've got. People need to understand that. submit with all of their hearts. Verse 2. For it shall be that as a wandering bird cast out of the nest, so the daughters of Moab shall be at the fords of Arnon. What do we see here? We see the destruction of Moab to such an extent that the daughters of Moab, and why does it mention daughters? Because all the men are dead. And they'll be as a wandering bird cast out of the nest. Now, what's a wandering bird cast out of the nest like? You ever knocked out a nest with a bunch of little birds in it? They sit on the ground there trembling with fright. They're afraid. They don't know what to do. It's a new environment. They are discarded fledglings, full of fear and confusion. Trembling. Verse 3. Take counsel, execute judgment, make thy shadow as the night in the midst of the noonday. Hide the outcasts, bewray not him that wanders. Verse 4, let mine outcasts dwell with thee, Moab. Be thou a cover to them from the face of the spoiler, and so forth. And I tie that in because what is probably happening here, there's a couple of different ways to take it. It's ambiguous and it's not real clear. One way to take it is this. Judah, now having requested them to submit unto Zion, send a sacrifice, is possibly now saying, protect the wanderers from Judah and show them mercy. Show them mercy. And God will have mercy on you. The last part of there, verse 3, says, hide the outcast, bewray not him that wanders. Hide him under your shadow. That's why they want the shadow to be so dark, so that they're hid under it. And in the noonday sun, you know what the noonday sun does? It beats. It beats. It's afflictive. The noonday sun is powerful and afflictive. It's not a blessing. The noonday sun is oppressive. And they need protection from that noonday sun, and they want their shadow to be black as the night. In other words, to hide everything that's under it. And so it's a request for protection. And because of what is said here in verse 4, let mine outcast dwell with thee, Moab, most feel, therefore, that Judah is saying, you hide our outcasts. When Assyria comes down and smashes the cities of Judah, when Assyria comes down and threatens us, when Babylon comes down and threatens us, when Rome comes down and threatens us, you hide our outcasts and you'll find mercy. That's a possibility. And Kyle and Dillich agree with that, and others. The other way to take it is a little more difficult to see, and that is that Moab is pleading to Judah for help and protection. Moab is pleading to Judah, and they are calling out to them, make your shadow as the night in the midst of the noonday. And you say, well, what about verse 4 where it says, let mine outcast dwell with thee, a Moab? The way you would translate that is you would take Moab as the ones crying out. And it's a little stilted in the Hebrew, but some feel that it could be taken that way. In other words, it would read like this. Let mine outcast dwell with thee, Moab. In other words, and Moab is just calling out, mentioning who it is, as if he were knocking at the door. Let me in. Let mine outcast dwell with thee, Moab. And that's the way another way you could take it. I feel like the first one is the simplest and fits best, particularly since Isaiah is calling to them to submit to Judah. And they're looking for a reprisal of mercy on the part of Moab's part when Judah's outcasts seek for help. Notice in verse 3 at the very beginning there, it says, take counsel, execute judgment. Well, see, that's what Moab needs to do if they're going to be delivered. That's their need to do. You know, you need to do that. When you got the judgment of God on your life, brother, you better do justice. Really, God will have mercy on you if you do what's right. But if you hide your sin, he won't. Verse 5. And in mercy shall the throne be established, and he shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David, in judging and seeking judgment and hasting righteousness. Now, this is a verse exalting David's throne. Now, David's dead and gone. It's talking about somebody that shall establish the throne in mercy. And essentially what it is saying is, Moab, if you will submit, you will find mercy from the throne of David. And when that would happen, of course, would be especially when they were fleeing from their oppressors, and also later under the Messiah. They would receive mercy from Jesus Christ, the Messiah. He would be the one that sits in mercy on the throne of David, wouldn't he? Judging and seeking judgment and hastening righteousness. That'd be Jesus Christ. Now, Ruth was a Moabitess, wasn't she? And she had mercy upon her husband and her mother-in-law, right? So God had mercy upon her. And she came in and she exalted the throne of David, and she was blessed and covered and preserved herself. And so it's almost a type is seen here in Ruth. And it's a call, really, that goes out to the Gentiles, although these were not, they were not in the covenant. They were related. They weren't in the covenant, but it would apply even to the Gentiles, that if they will have mercy upon Israel, God will have mercy upon them, if they'll be good to the church. There's people out here that they're not saved, and they'll never get saved. But because they are willing to give mercy to the church, God's going to have mercy on them the day of judgment. It's the truth. All right, verse 6. We have heard of the pride of Moab. He is very proud, even of his haughtiness and his pride and his wrath, but his lies shall not be so. Now we just got a request for mercy to Moab if they would just submit and help Judah. But now it's back to the general tenor of Moab's heart, and that is pride. Jeremiah 48:29 mentions the same thing. Pride was Moab's great fall. Remember now, the Moabites are related to the Jews. And there would be a type here of the visible church, practically. It's not the cities of Judah so much, but they're related. They're somewhat akin. And what do you see filling them up? It's pride. And so also some of the religious systems of the world that try to liken themselves to Christianity. They're somewhat related, but there's no salvation. They don't accept the Messiah or anything. And what is the ground of their religion? It's pride. Their problem is pride. But his lies shall not be so. His lies shall prove to be vain. And the Bible teaches us very clearly that those who live by lies, they shall not come to pass. They shall be destroyed. Isaiah 25:10-12. Therefore shall Moab howl for Moab. Everyone shall howl. For the foundations of Kir-Hareseth shall ye mourn. Surely they are stricken. Foundations here is, some say, is ruins. But more probably, some say, it's raisin cakes. The raisin cakes shall mourn, meaning there aren't any. There aren't any. The raisin cakes of Kir-Hareseth shall ye mourn. Surely they are stricken. That would, of course, be a blessing and so forth. And the major export, by the way, of the city Kir-Hareseth was raisin cakes. And this also agrees with verse 8. For the fields of Heshbon languish and the vine of Sibmah. See, and so they wouldn't have any raisin cakes. So anyway, they're mourning because there's no more blessing in the land. Verse 8. For the fields of Heshbon languish and the vine of Sibmah. The lords of the heathen have broken down the principal plants thereof. They are come even unto Jazer. They wandered through the wilderness. Their branches are stretched out. They are gone over the sea. It speaks of the desolation and the carrying away of the nation of Moab. The vines and the branches going over the sea is probably referring to them being carried away captive. Carried away captive. Taken away. And the branches is the fruit of the vine, and that's probably referring to more of the principal people. The branches referring to more of the principal people, the people of high station, maybe the rich. The rich ones among them. Verse 9. Therefore I will bewail with the weeping of Jazer, the vine of Sibmah. I will water thee with my tears, O Heshbon and Elilah, for the shouting for thy summer fruits and for thy harvest is fallen. Now Jazer, the weeping of Jazer. Jazer was greatly destroyed, and therefore there's great lamentation. And by the way, might I say, that the land of Moab today, most of these cities that I'm discussing are totally wiped out. You won't find them. They're under the sand. You have to dig down to find the ruins. So the judgment of God has come to pass. And Jazer was greatly destroyed, and therefore great lamentation. Now notice, he says, I will bewail with the weeping of Jazer, the vine of Sibma. We see here the prophet identifies with Moab. He mourns for them. He shows a heart of compassion. Now notice, you didn't see that from Babylon, did you? There's no mercy to Babylon. It's the extension of the devil himself and total destruction. But Moab, now they were related. They were closer. They should have been part of the covenant. That was Lot's descendants who were through Nahor, Abraham's father. And so here we see the heart of God. It's as if Abraham is in Isaiah crying out and crying for his relative Lot. Essentially, it almost sounds like they could have been saved if it were not for their pride. They could have been saved. They could have come in. God had accepted them. He'd let them come into the covenant, but their pride would not let them. What makes Abraham more exalted than Lot would be their sentiment. The summer fruits and the harvest is fallen. And brother, when the summer fruits and the harvest is fallen, you haven't got anything. The summer fruits, that's a blessing. And the harvest, you haven't got anything. If you haven't got the harvest, so they're in total desolation. That pretty much includes the food that they would eat. Verse 10, and gladness is taken away, and joy out of the plentiful field, and in the vineyards there shall be no singing, neither shall there be shouting. The treaders shall tread out no wine in their presses. I have made their vintage shouting to cease. Now this is one of the greatest of joys, the gladness and the joy of the vineyard. And it was the time of singing. You recall that the Feast of Tabernacles was at the time of the treading out of the grapes. And it is said that there was not a happier time in the whole year than at the treading out of the grapes. And they also said that at the Feast of Tabernacles, you never saw rejoicing and joy in your life if you've never seen the rejoicing at the Feast of Tabernacles. One of the Jewish proverbs. And it's pointing out desolation to a people that could have been saved. Now this can also talk about the church. No more blessing of God. No more wine of rejoicing. No more Spirit of God. It's dead. It's dry. It's cold. It's lifeless. There's no joy. Have you ever visited a church and looked for joy? You don't find it. You don't find people just rejoicing in God and praising God and saying, hallelujah, unless there's Spirit-filled going on with God. It's just not there. Okay. Verse 11. Wherefore my bowels shall sound like a harp for Moab, and mine inward parts for Kir Haris. Here we see again Isaiah's heart. He had the heart of God. God so loved the world. And here he's loving Moab. He takes no pleasure in their destruction. He is pronouncing judgment upon them because of their sin. But he mourns because they could have been justified. They could have been exalted. If they would have just submitted under the kingdom of David, they'd have just submitted under the Christ. And see, isn't this the way it is? Sometimes there's Babylons out there and they just need to be destroyed. But you know, there's Moabites out there. They don't need to be destroyed. God would have mercy on them if they'd repent. And they could have the wine of rejoicing. And so our bowels sound like a harp. And the harp is more of a melodious, it can be a mournful sound, depending on the strings that you pull. But it's talking about the sound of mourning that his bowels is making. And the bowels here is referring to the innermost being, the place where it stirs you up the most. Where it stirs you up the most. Verse 12. I'm just going to say, if Mondale gets in office, I'm going to be stirred up. I'm going to be praying. My bowels are going to sound like a harp. But I tell you, we should be praying and interceding whoever gets in office in the next 4 years. Because, you know, there are other conservative men that could be put in office on down the line. I mean, we could have conservative presidents for some time. You know, on the other hand, every conservative president could, be another step towards world government. You know, you just don't know. The devil is sly. What is conservative? Just like some of the things that have happened when they in Arkansas when they had that discussion on creation in the classroom. And it was supposedly the state attorney on the side of creation being able to be brought in the classrooms versus a bunch of ACLU representatives. And the guy, they feel later, the guy that was the attorney general that was standing up for creationism, but it was a hoax. The guy acted stupid. He bumbled in his answers. He made it look foolish. He did not come through with the real truth. There are people on the sidelines saying, step out of the way. Let a lawyer in there that knows what he's talking about. And they feel like it was planned that way. What am I getting at? I'm getting at some in office. The answer isn't always just who's in office, although because of what God has caused to be on the platforms of the different parties this year, at least since I've been around, I have never known of or heard of a more religiously morality-centered race than this one in the history, of the United States. I haven't known, and that's because it hasn't been the biggest issue. In the past, all the presidents general, there was a certain moral standard of the nation. But since that's been lost now, now there's a fight to gain it back. And so now the lines are drawn. I mean, they really are. And so today is going to say a lot. It really is. Because it's not just a matter of, the poor. We were down at the Bible Answer Stand yesterday, and this old couple, were talking to my wife. They said, Ronald Reagan, he's the Antichrist. And they wouldn't listen to anything. They would not listen. Said he's the Antichrist. There's six letters in Ronald, six letters in his middle name, and six letters in Reagan. 666, Ronald Reagan, Antichrist. But here they are using a spiritual concept when, when you're from Mondale, you're not too spiritually oriented. What are they doing bringing up a spiritual concept? Them being the Antichrist, taking all the food from the poor, giving to the rich, That's such a slam, such a lie. That doesn't sound any much better than, I don't know if you look at the voters' pamphlet there, but you look at Gus Hall and Angela. About what that sounds like. they didn't come right out and say it, but what they're looking for is the violent overthrow of America. That Reagan is the Antichrist?
Where did they hear that?
Yeah, the preachers are preaching that Reagan is the Antichrist. I don't know. I can't hardly believe it. There are some that are real conservative that have been upset at Reagan because he hasn't come swung clear to their side. And so they're not thinking. They're fighting against their own cause, Ask the guy, hey, come on, we're supposed to be smart as serpents. You're being a dumbbell. The only one you're pushing into office is Mondale, If Reagan's the Antichrist, he's Satan himself, brother, wake up. Wake up.
More like a liberal...
smear.
Liberal spirit, and
yeah.
Christ spirit, it's just like during the mid-50s,
when he's in
communist everywhere.
Right, exactly.
Just take
mind off of what's really happening. That's right. Try to appeal to the sector that is supposedly listening to Reagan, Many of those are Christians, and they don't like the Antichrist. And so, well, if Reagan's the Antichrist, and there are some probably dumb enough to believe it. There are a lot of people out there, they don't know what to believe. All they've got is the liberal press and the media. They don't hardly read anything else. So anyway, evidently the Times, Seattle Times, came out with some pro-Reagan statements. Pardon me? They endorsed Reagan. Well, anyway, did you see some of the letters that they got? Whew. Burn your ears off. Now, that's what it is. It's the 5% out there that are liberal, activist, militant, hired by communists, full of the devil. Well, I hope if they'd have endorsed Mondale, there would have been a few of us writing in there saying, of course I don't take their paper. I won't have it, but anyway. Lines are being drawn. But here he is. His bowels are sounding like a harp for Moab. All right, verse 12. Going on with his judgment. And it shall come to pass, when it is seen that Moab is weary on the high place, that he shall come to his sanctuary to pray, but he shall not prevail. He's weary on his high place, meaning Moab has gone to his high places to try to get to God. He never made it. And so now he's coming to his temple his sanctuary, but he shall not prevail. So now he's going even to a more formal place of worship of their gods. It's amazing what people will do. When it's obvious God's judgment is on them, they'll go to the gods. They'll go to their heathen idols. It's like people, when they see judgment of God on their life, they just turn to sin. That's so stupid. That's so stupid. They get found out. Things befall them and say, well, I'm going to quit being a Christian. You know, well, I'm going to start drinking. They just give up. They just go out and start serving idols as if they have any answer for them. They don't have any answer. Obadiah, verse 15. The book of Obadiah deals with Moab and Edom. Tremendous amount of judgment in the book of Obadiah. Say Joel, Amos, Obadiah. I want to read verse 15. For the day of the Lord is near upon all the heathen. As thou hast done, it shall be done unto thee. Thy reward shall return upon thine own head. And here we see it. It's coming back upon Esau especially. And that's right, Esau especially. I guess it's on Esau. Excuse me, a slip of my memory. Obadiah is mainly against Esau. But they see that there's no help because the judgment of God is upon him. We see this also at the second coming, just like we saw in Obadiah 15, also Joel 3, verse 7 and 8. And so we see the nation of Moab was very close to the covenant because of Lot, and yet so far away because of their heart. So far away because of their heart. It's exactly what you see. You see people in America, they got churches on every corner, but their heart is so far away. And now they're turning to their sanctuaries. They go from their high places to the sanctuaries, and yet they cannot prevail because they're seeking help from demons. Verse 13. This is the word that the Lord hath spoken concerning Moab since that time. But now the Lord has spoken, saying. Now what does he mean is this. Formerly, this is what God has spoken concerning Moab, his destruction. For instance, we see it in Exodus chapter 15 and verse 15. So formerly, God has been saying this, and this is what he's been saying all along. And he's saying it again here in Isaiah 15 and 16. And Exodus 15, 15. Then the dukes of Edom shall be amazed. The mighty men of Moab, trembling, shall take hold upon them. All the inhabitants of Canaan shall melt away. So it's a prophecy about their destruction. And also Numbers 21:29. And it's not a total destruction and annihilation that's being viewed here, but a destruction. In 21:29 it says, Woe to thee, Moab! Thou art undone, O people of Chemosh! He hath given his sons that escaped, and his daughters into captivity unto Sihon, king of the Amorites. And so it's woe to Moab. So God foreknew that this is what was going to happen to Moab. Now, this is what he had spoken since that time, or formally. But verse 14 says, But now the Lord has spoken. So God formally has predicted the destruction of Moab. Now what does God say? Within 3 years, as the years of a hireling, and the glory of Moab shall be contemned, with all that great multitude, and the remnant shall be very small and feeble. What do we see here? Before it was long range. Now it's very specific. What is 3 years as the years of a hireling? 3 years as a hireling is a specific, prearranged, unalterable time period. Specific, prearranged, unalterable time period. Why? Because a person, a hireling that is hired, he's not going to work any more than he's hired, but the employer won't let him work any less than for what he's hired. So 3 years as a hireling is 3 years, brother. It's 3 years. They enter into an agreement, and he won't work any more, and the employer won't let him work any less, and so that's how much he's going to work. Exactly 3 years. In Isaiah 21 and verse 16. It says again, For thus hath the Lord said unto me, Within a year, according to the years of a hireling, and all the glory of Kedar shall fail. And that means specific, 1 year. Now we know it was finally accomplished. We know that the judgment finally happened, that there was a great multitude destroyed, and the remnant was small and feeble. We know that, as mentioned in Jeremiah 48:16. And as mentioned in Isaiah 25, 10, and 12. When did it happen and by whom did it happen is the question. Now, if this is within 3 years is the years of a hireling, it most probably was by somebody from Assyria, but not necessarily. Now, if it would have been Assyria, it would have been Sennacherib. It would have been Sennacherib. And this is the one that would seem to fit the best, but see, we don't have any record, like I mentioned to you when we started talking about Moab. And if this is the case, then Sennacherib must have come down and taken Moab and the areas surrounding before he entered into Judah. And in the earlier years of Hezekiah, that would be seem to fit the best. Shalmaneser is a little bit too early for this because we're getting right close now down to Assyria being surrounding Jerusalem. Some say it's possible that it was the king of Ethiopia. Now that's another possibility. It's another possibility. In 2 Kings chapter 19 and verse 9, we see this. We see that he was around at this time. And remember, it was the king of Ethiopia that Hezekiah was being tempted to get help from. Remember? When Sennacherib surrounded Jerusalem. But 2 Kings 19:9 says this. Well, let me read verse 8. So Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria warring against Libnah, for he had heard that he was departed from Lachish. When he had heard say of Tirhakah, king of Ethiopia, behold, he has come out to fight against thee, he sent messengers again unto Hezekiah, saying, let not the God whom you trust deceive you, saying that you shall not be delivered into Assyria. Don't think that Tirhakah of Ethiopia is going to deliver you. So that's the other possibility. Because Tirhakah evidently had done some raids and some advances around the area at the same time that Sennacherib and his armies were down in Judah. So that's the other possibility. We don't know exactly. It doesn't say. But we see that there's a remnant left of Moab. Now, Nebuchadnezzar undoubtedly did much destruction upon Moab. Nebuchadnezzar did. And very definitely, at the Battle of Armageddon, there's going to be a lot of destruction upon Moab. So, it's going to be fulfilled. The prophecy is going to be finally fulfilled. But 3 years is the years of the hireling. Brother, we're talking about right away. Pretty specific prophecy. All right, chapter 17. Yes, sir.
Aside from the pride, I really don't see any reason why God is bringing all this destruction. I mean, it's awesome destruction.
But they worship the god of Chemosh.
Oh, they did?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was their main god. Yeah, that was their main god. They were idolaters. They caused their children to pass into the fire. And they were heathens. They were very rough on Judah. They did not accept the outcasts of Judah. Esau was even worse. We'll look at him later. There will soon be a judgment on Esau. But they were ungodly. And they were cantankerous with Judah. They were not sweet to Judah. They were not helpful. They wouldn't protect their outcasts. They were very proud. And so God broke them. That's right. That's right. That's right. They were idolaters of a very worse sort. You know, it's hard to even imagine people doing that type of thing. Throwing their kids to a fire like that. I mean, it's just hard to imagine. The beating of drums and everything. Ah, just makes you sick. Yes?
Could you compare the Moabites and
the
religion to, like, Canaanites before Joshua?
The what?
The Canaanites before Joshua?
Yes. Oh yeah, there was a lot of similarity of worship, sure. Because they were there before Judah came in, before Israel actually came in, right? Because they settled that area and they stayed there after Lot. And whereas Abraham and his seed, they went down to Egypt. And they were there for, you know, several centuries. So yes, all that worship of that area was pretty bad. The Edomites were bound in it too. But God did have more mercy on Edom and Moab than he did on the Canaanites. The Canaanites have been wiped out. The Edomites and Moabites haven't. There's still a remnant. Remnant of them. There's still a people there. It's spread among the Arabians now, but the Canaanites were destroyed. See, the Philistines were destroyed. They're annihilated. They're no longer in existence. And pretty much so with the Canaanites. And well, what about the Samaritans, the mixtures? They're gone. Samaritans are pretty much gone. There's just a couple hundred of them over in Palestine. And I was talking to Elias Matar. He said that they intermarry and they just live among themselves. They're just like a little community. They don't deal with the outside world. Jews, Samaritans. So, you know, all the seed that have come out of that land has been pretty much wiped out. Except there's still some of Esau. There's still, you know, Ishmael has still got his seed in there. Esau has still got his seed in there. And Lot's children, Moab and Ammon, they've still got a little bit of seed in there. I think, especially Moab, I think most of the Ammonites are gone. Okay, chapter 17. Now, the destruction in chapter 17 is mainly directed towards northern Israel and also somewhat applying to Syria. You say, well, northern Israel has already been broken. Yes, that's right. In 722, Samaria was taken and destroyed under a horrible siege. And it was much of it was taken captive. But the land has not yet been totally overrun, and it has not been re-inhabited with the heathen. And that was done under Esarhaddon, and that's not until about 686. So that's not a while yet. Or 669 it was. So, northern Israel is still being judged by God. There's still judgments coming against it, and this is what we're seeing in chapter 17. And also, not only northern Israel, but Syria. But we'll see that both are included. The burden of Damascus. Behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap. Now, Damascus was the capital of Syria, but it was also sometimes the capital, or the sometimes controlled by northern Israel, or Ephraim. I'll just call it Ephraim. Actually, Damascus became the chief power of both nations, both Syria and Ephraim. Now, Damascus had already been defeated by Tiglath-Pileser in the fourth year of Ahaz. So that's quite a while before this time, 2 Kings 16:9. But there's even a greater destruction now prophesied. Now, it's going to be a ruinous heap. A ruinous heap. Now, Damascus has definitely gone through many destructions. But this probably does not fully apply until the Battle of Armageddon. And evidently, Damascus will then become that ruinous heap. Damascus right now is a large, thriving city. Most of these others, as we've mentioned, are totally destroyed and wiped out. So this one is probably waiting until the end time of the Battle of Armageddon. Verse 2. The cities of Aroer are forsaken. They shall be for flocks, which shall lie down, and none shall make them afraid. Now the cities of Aroer are seven cities. And we see them in Joshua 15, verse 44, and they're on the river Jabbok. Now the river Jabbok is the river that sticks right in the middle of Jordan. It comes right into the river Jordan. And those cities are destroyed. All you find over there is places for sheep. It's a wilderness area. That's all it is. Verse 3. The fortress also shall cease from Ephraim, and the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria. They shall be as the glory of the children of Israel, saith the Lord of hosts. Now, what kind of glory of the children of Israel are they going to have then? No glory at all. Because the children of Israel forsook their glory. They forsook God. And so, they'll be totally carried away, and they'll lose any glory that they had. Now, notice it says, in the remnant of Syria. The fortress shall cease from the remnant of Syria. The remnant of Syria would be those left after Tiglath-Pileser had destroyed Damascus and other cities around there. But the end result is they're all going to lose their glory. And they have. Hosea chapter 9, verses 11 and 12 talks about that destruction. And we see that both Ephraim and Syria lost their glory. Verse 4. And in that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. Now Jacob, he's the one who deceives. He's the deceiver. And here it's used to represent Ephraim, northern Israel. Now why was his glory made thin? The reason why is because he was trusting in Damascus for his help and for his glory. And they trusted Damascus to help them against Assyria. Well, it didn't work. Now, there's another possibility. The other possibility that here, since it uses the word Jacob instead of Israel, or northern Israel or Ephraim, since it uses the word Jacob, it's possible it's referring to both houses. And that it's also including Jerusalem, that is Judah. That's possible. That their glory is wearing thin too, because they were being tempted to trust in other nations instead of the living God. And I'll tell you, glory wears thin when you start trusting in man, that's for sure. Now, let me just give you a spiritual application here. Do you know what our glory is? Our glory is when we're walking in the victory and God is upon our life, but it grows real thin when we start looking to man for help. It grows real thin. We do not have the same protection in our life. We do not have the same strength. We're not waiting upon God. And at a time like that, though, when the glory grows thin, we begin to see the real issue. It reminds me of other scriptures where it says, under judgment, that our flesh becomes lean. See, and the fatness has turned to leanness. Well, you know what happens when you become lean? You can begin to see your bones. Your bones stick out. And you know what your bones represent? They represent the inner man. And some of us, we will not listen to our spirit, and we will not listen to our inner man until God brings us down to starvation. And our bones start sticking out. Now we begin to see him. Now we begin to deal with him. See? He takes us down into starvation, and then we begin to understand, I've got a spirit. And the spirit needs to be fed. Okay. Verse 5. And it shall be as when the harvest man gathers the corn and reaps the ears with his arm, and it shall be as he that gathers ears in the valley of Rephaim. Now, how do they gather a fertile crop? They take it all away, and they leave very little gleanings, just a little bit. And the valley of Rephaim is a very fertile plain southwest of Jerusalem towards Bethlehem. And that's another reason why some feel it may be including Judah here. The valley of Rephaim is a very fertile plain southwest of Jerusalem toward Bethlehem. And so they take it all away, and they leave but little. And that's what happened to northern Israel, 2 Kings 18, 9 through 11. Verse 6, yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it, as the shaking of an olive tree. Two or three berries in the top of the uppermost bough, four or five in the outmost fruitful branches thereof, saith the Lord God of Israel. In other words, there were a few left way out there on the top of the uppermost bough and so forth, the outmost fruitful branches. They're hard to get at. They stick on strong. Maybe they're not fully ripe, but later they'll be ripe, and so they are left. And we see that that's exactly what happened, that there were those that God spared. There were those that came back. There were those that became part of Samaria, and later they got saved under the preaching of Jesus and under the preaching of Philip. That's right, there were those that stayed. Now, they were the poor of the land out of northern Israel. And they were intermarried, mingled with the heathen. But later they were preached to by Christ and then by Philip. Yes. Okay. I think the point is that there's going to be, it's taking a different picture. I'm not sure exactly if it's trying to show the nature of those that are left, but in a very fruitful wheat harvest, there's usually not a lot left. And that's the basic idea. And in the other, there's not a lot left either, only it's in a different figure. And so I think it's showing the totality, the emphasis, I think, in verse 5 is how most of it's taken away. And in verse 6, but that there are a few left. That were hard to reach, and that God had mercy on some of the more righteous ones, some of them that remained behind, some of the poor of the land, and so forth. I think that's the main idea. Do you see anything else in there?
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, they're not talking about grapes in the first
line. Right.
And I'm wondering if usually grapes and things usually refer more to the wine, and the wine rejoicing, enjoy, or a sweet thing usually refer. That's a different application. I'm wondering if they just follow that same train of thought and say, well, there's still a couple handfuls of wheat left.
Well, I'm not sure. We got the grapes, but we also have the olive tree in verse 6, and those are put together. Those are both from trees. Those are grown above ground. The corn or the grain, that's referring to that which comes, you know, from the earth. I'm not really sure, because see, we have three images actually there, not just two. We have the grain, we have the olive, and we have the grape. So there's really three. And the main idea that we can be sure of, and I don't really see much else, and that is that there's very few left, but there are a few. There is a remnant. And that God does have some of northern Israel, and he does have some of Syria that are going to receive his covenant. And as I mentioned, to the Samaritans that has happened, and some that came down into Jerusalem that happened, and so forth. But largely they're destroyed and carried away. We also see this in Ezekiel 37, verses 11 and 12. Ezekiel 37, 11 and 12. Let me read that. Then he said unto me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say, our bones are dried and our hope is lost. We are cut off for our parts. Now, this is down at the time of Ezekiel. This is down when they're in Babylon. Therefore prophesy and say unto them, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, O my people, I will open your graves and cause you to come out of your graves and bring you into the land of Israel. So there will be some of northern Israel. This is the whole house of Israel. So there were a few grapes. There were a few gleanings. There were a few olives in the outermost branches that they couldn't reach. Okay. Verse 7. At that day shall a man look to his maker, and his eyes shall have respect to the Holy One of Israel. And he shall look not to the altars. Now the time is the time of judgment, when there is a wipeout except for a small remnant. And that small remnant are going to give honor to God. From this we see that though northern Israel was a real wipeout, there were still some righteous ones among them. There were some righteous ones among them. And they turned to God with their whole heart. It's through purging, brethren, that pure motives come out to the surface. Our motives are so impure sometimes. They're so wrong. They're so twisted. But after you've been through the fires, and after you've got stomped on a little bit, that really helps purify the motives. Micah chapter 7 and verse 7. Parallel passage to this. Micah 7:7. I had it here. There we go. Therefore I will look unto the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. And here we see that one that had gone through great judgment now is looking to God again, Israel. That's what's happening here. Now notice, they will have respect unto who? His maker. They recognize they've got to be remade. They'll have respect unto their maker. Not their savior, not their king, not anything else, but to their maker. And pointing out their need to be remade, and pointing out that they are the creation of God. Now this ties right into the covenant. In Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, we are created in Christ Jesus. Ephesians 2:10. And 2 Corinthians 5:17, if any man be in Christ, he's a new creation. And so this is possibly what he's looking at. And we see through this also, therefore, that this remnant is none other, well, there's double application, but spiritually speaking, this remnant is none other than those that believe on Jesus Christ that come out of Israel. That's the remnant. There were those that stuck. There were those that remained. There was a seed of northern Israel that did believe on Jesus Christ, and they still are. There still is a remnant that is coming unto Christ, returning unto Christ. Verse 8. And he shall not look to the altars, the work of his hands, neither shall respect that which his fingers have made, either the groves or the images. Now this is a very amazing prophecy, because it seemed like Israel was constantly full of idolatry. But the day will come when she won't have idolatry, and we'll talk about that in later.